Hello and welcome to edition 386 of the Monocle Weekly. I'm Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we'll welcome back Darren Wall, the publisher whose beautifully designed books are shedding new light on the technology industry. He'll be talking gaming and his new book, The Bitmap Brothers Universe, a little later.
And we'll also hear from American musician David Parho, whose eclectic career has ranged from expansive rock to pop bands and more experimental sounds too. He'll be talking about his latest record, Highway Songs.
And we'll be getting some instructions on how to live our lives a little better, hopefully, from design duo Special Projects. They'll be telling us why they've put some helpful wellness tips into a manual as simple as flat pack furniture.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan will be down on his hands and knees, looking under the sofa for the essential lost bit of the news look ahead. And we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, and that's on Monocle 24.
Well, Andrew, here we are again. Sorry, just dominated by that image of Henry Reece Sheridan down on his hands and knees. What did you say he was looking for again?
Well,
all will be revealed.
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not all revealed.
Exactly.
How are you?
Pretty good. A good week. A slightly quieter, calmer week.
Yes, we sent the forecast to print even. That must have been on Tuesday, a couple of days later than we'd hoped to send it.
Rap on the knuckles.
But it's a bit of a beast, so it's done. And now it just feels like being on a kind of a slide heading for Christmas at rather full pelt.
A fun seasonal holiday slide.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of things happening. We have a bit of a trip to kind of see all the bureaus before Christmas and do some events in market. We've got new books coming out. The Toronto City Guide is just heading out to the stores now. Yeah, it's a bit, busy old time.
Gifts that keep on giving.
Yes, so lots of things to buy for Christmas. Go to monocle.com, as they say.
Time for the present that nobody wanted to see under the tree this year. Henry Reece Sheridan.
Henry said he's ready when we are, but he seems to be slurping water ahead of this this news look ahead. You need to be refreshed and revived, do you, Henry?
I need to be lubricated. I got very excited about the news look ahead, so I just want to make sure that I'm prepared. Okay. I'm ready now.
Well, now you're fully lubricated. Why didn't you start?
On the 4th of December, Andrew, Italy is holding a constitutional referendum on changes to their upper house. Now, I'm sure both of you have read about this and the way it's been transformed into a kind of metaphor for people's approval or lack thereof on Matteo Renzi, the Italian Prime Minister.
Well, he said he's going to resign if he doesn't win.
Precisely.
I've heard that somewhere before.
Well, you were saying, actually, in an editorial meeting earlier this week, Tom, that you think that Cameron should have said that he was going to resign earlier in the Brexit referendum process. Now, interestingly, lots of people think that the fact that...
Do you think that... Oh, can I just point out that he's not very good on these guesses? Do you think that would have pushed people one way or the other?
No, I think a lot of people didn't realise that he would necessarily resign immediately in the event that the Brexiteers were successful. I think they didn't realise the sheer level of upheaval. And I think he personally could have made it a bit clearer exactly what was at stake. But also in that meeting, and we talked about, you know, the beginnings of that whole referendum being in the Tory manifesto. It was a potential bargaining chip to get rid of if they were in a coalition, which they didn't have to be because they won outright. What's interesting about this Italian vote is it's rather different. It's become a proxy, but it hasn't gone through that cycle. It hasn't been twisted from a manifesto pledge to something else. It's just taken on this life of its own within an existing parliament.
But the thing is, lots of people think that the fact that Renzi has said early on, I'm going to step down if I lose this, it's personalised the referendum in a way that actually makes it more likely that he's going to lose. And in any case, is just encouraging people to basically vote on an issue which they're not actually voting for, which is something that I think that we've seen time and time again in referenda. You don't like me using that, though, do you?
I prefer referendums. Where do you stand, Andrew?
I don't mind.
Go in referendums this year. And my second story today is related. So I thought we could fuse them together into a super story. And that's that Switzerland is going to be holding a referendum on withdrawal from nuclear energy on the 27th of November. So there's been a proposal put forward to phase out nuclear energy and try to invest more in renewable energies. And obviously the Swiss have this extraordinary direct democracy system in place. Incidentally, just talking about Swiss direct democracy, would you like to hear a remarkable fact of a Sunday afternoon?
I'd love one.
I certainly would.
Do you know in what year Swiss women attained universal suffrage, attained the right to vote at the federal level?
I believe it's something as late as 1970.
Tom?
I'll go even a little later because it's obviously going to be shockingly late. 1980?
It's 1971.
Oh, well, that's only a year out.
Wow, that's good.
How about that, hey?
And one thing that I think's as remarkable is that that law was passed by a all-male referendum, which I think is quite a remarkable fact. Back to the main story. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah,
I thought you did.
Good.
I could
good
tell from your reaction.
Yeah, no, I was silent was because it's still sinking in.
Still sinking in. Now, this was the first year after the Fukushima disaster in Japan, but even though this is, you know, again, what you would imagine to be an extraordinarily process-driven technocratic decision, apparently a lot of the opposition to the proposal is coming from conservatives who just on principle are voting against it because it was proposed by garlic-munching environmentalists. Garlic-munching? Granola-munching. That's a stereotype, isn't it? Don't know why I'm talking about garlic.
Well, unless they're kind of like, you know, bloodsuckers as well.
Exactly, I'm sure many conservatives feel.
Environmentalists.
But I know it's all kind of a bit queasy making, but in the end you have to decide whether you like democracy or not. And if you like democracy, you have to kind of put up with the fact that people make some really rubbish decisions.
Well, this is precisely the conversation that I hope to start, because I think that this year, more than any other year in recent political history, has really thrown into relief, particularly for people, you know, on the more liberal side of things who might have been knee-jerk advocates for, you know, deeply entrenched advocates for more democracy, greater transparency. There's been a lot of democratic decisions which have been made, which are against their will, against their interests, many of them would see. And I think it has brought into relief some tensions in the democratic process, which are interesting. You're nodding, Tom. Do you have anything to say?
No, but it was interesting, I think, for people on the liberal, the soft centre, as it were, if you live there and you know, mentally, which I certainly do, is that, you know, you tend to be lulled by history into thinking that things are heading in a certain direction. Yeah, there'll be setbacks, but you're kind of heading in a certain course, you know, whether that's kind of, you know, women's rights, gay rights, if it's relief of poverty. You think, on the whole, we're heading normally as nations in the right direction. And the question that comes up for the last few thunderbolts that we've been hit with is, actually, do people not actually want to really head in that direction? So, you know, you saw a lot of women vote for Donald Trump in the election, and it made lots of kind of liberals think, well, actually, maybe there's a lot of women who don't give a damn about women's liberation. And you saw, you know, gay people voting for Trump. You thought, well, actually, maybe there's a lot of gay people who don't actually care about their social equality. They'd just rather support somebody who backs up their views in other ways. So I think that feeling that, you know, you're always heading in one direction at the moment, I think lots of people feel a bit unsure because you feel, you know, we just don't know where we're going.
And finally, on the 27th of November as well, the French opposition Les Républicains party, Tom, for you, that's French for the Republicans.
Thanks for helping me out.
Are going to hold a runoff in their presidential primary. Now, the last round, the first round, as you know, saw the crushing defeat of Sarko, Nicolas Sarkozy. Who's a figure I'm sad to see disappear from the world political stage. I enjoyed the light-hearted banter that surrounded his character. His height, meanly, let's be honest, no one deserves that. But he used to wear little heeled booties, didn't he?
Yes.
And, yeah, so Alain Juppé is still in the running to compete, as well as François Fillon, I think that's how you pronounce his name. Mm-hmm. And it looks like whoever's going to win this is going to go on, probably, given Hollande's unpopularity, to face Marie Le Pen for the presidency.
Plenty at stake.
Plenty at stake,
and
indeed.
It's interesting, because a lot of people said, actually, is it more difficult to defeat Marine Le Pen from the right, in the sense that sometimes a very stark choice, or a more stark choice, it's kind of easier, it resonates with the electorate. I'm not quite sure how it will measure up, but it's certainly going to be most interesting.
It's going to be a belter.
Yeah, and Fernando the other day brought on to one of the shows a really great map that was on front of Le Monde, which just showed who had won which constituencies and territories in the last round. And Sarkozy had like only one district in mainland France, and then he'd got Corsica, and that was it. That was all that he had managed to hold on to.
Corsica, extraordinary, because again, and people said, oh, you know, a lot of people had backed him to be the key challenger from the kind of mainstream.
Yeah, this is the guy that was the president just a few years ago.
Yeah, it's really amazing.
Well, watch this space.
Thank
and of course,
you, Henry.
We'll be covering it extensively in Monocle 24, I should say.
Around a year ago on the Monocle Weekly, almost to the day, in fact, we met Darren Wall, designer and editor-in-chief of publishing house Read Only Memory. Darren's speciality is focusing on the history of video games, but he presents this fairly niche world via an accessible, tried-and-tested medium, beautifully designed books.
And he's back today to tell us about his latest release, The Bitmap Brothers Universe, which looks at the story of influential UK game designers, the Bitmap Brothers. They were neither brothers, nor, as our more technology-savvy listeners might deduct, pixelated graphics, like their namesake suggests. Andrew and I, well, we're a little bit lost already, so we'll let Darren fill us in with the rest. Darren, welcome back to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks
good to have you with
me.
Us here at Monocle again. I guess this is interesting because a bit like last time when we spoke, this is about the origin story, if you like, of some of these video games. Now, in the world of movies or in the world of fiction, for example, often these origin stories sometimes become better known even than the works at the end.
Absolutely.
But with computer games, that's not really been the case. Why do you think that is? Why does it take maybe, even a generation before people start to dig back into the past?
Yeah, so I think journalism at the time, as in games journalism, wasn't really equipped to kind of document this stuff that was going on. I mean, games journalism at the time of the Bitmap Brothers inception, which is the end of the 80s and the start of the 90s, was just kind of coming to fruition. You know, like game reviews were becoming a sort of templated form, but the equipment, as in a journalistic equipment, to actually go beyond that and document the people and document the process, there wasn't even really the language there. I mean, we've only just started calling, they were called software houses at the time, but now we call them, you know, like dev teams. Like, we're getting that language now, but at the time it was a really early industry. So documentary-wise, nothing really existed. So we're kind of having to go back and do that now.
So tell us a little bit about the human story, who the Bitmap Brothers were. It begins back in the early 1980s, and it kind of almost begins on the shop floor of a Woolworths department store.
Yeah, it begins in Woolworths, yeah, an 80s institution. Mike Montgomery, who was one of the founder members, was working in Woolworths and became sort of distracted by computer technology to the point where he gave up smoking to be able to afford a ZX81 Spectrum to learn to code. And that led him into taking a pay cut to take a job coding video games. It was like a new passion for him. It was curiosity, you know, it wasn't documented, it wasn't a kind of accepted career route, it was a bit of a gamble. And it started to pay off for him, and he found he had an actual flair for it.
And just being an idiot, just remind me, 1981, where are we in the appearance of computer games at this point?
So we're at the end of the 8-bit era, if that kind of makes sense. So we've seen Asteroids sort of come and go. Computer games are still quite pixelated, they're colourful, and the home computer era is just beginning. So you've got these kind of £300-400 computers that are being available on the high street that are kind of moving into the home. Even the manufacturers don't know how to pitch them. Are they kind of desktop publishing aids? Are they accounting aids? Or are they games machines? Like, they're just kind of entering the home, and everyone's very curious. And in a very British way, we're starting to tinker with them and see what we can do with them.
I was going to say, and before you take us through the story, that, you know, Montgomery, what's his piece of luck in a way in starting out in 1981?
Actually, it's 1988, near the end of the 80s. Yeah, it's that point where anything is possible, really. Publishers and the people who are selling video games on the high street still don't quite know what they've got on their hand. They don't know how to price it. So games are coming in at like £1, £2.99. Some of them are £12, some of them are £16. Like, you're seeing this industry form and like price points starting to happen. And it's really early. Like, there are so few coders, so few talented coders in the industry. They're getting snapped up immediately, and money's being thrown at projects that they're kind of coming up with on the back of fag packets in pubs. So it's a really exciting kind of like Wild West time for the industry.
Well, let's dig into that modern mythology then of the Wild West. Tell us a bit more about the story and how you pieced the pieces together, because I guess it was a question of You mentioned already the journalistic resources weren't there at the time to document it. Was this all about raiding what archive there was? Was it more about actually trying to find these people and talking to them face to face?
Yeah, it was about trying to find them. I mean, when we use crowdfunding to fund our books. When we started the crowdfunding campaign 2 years ago, we thought we'd have around like 12 people to speak to, really core people who could talk about the Bitmap Brothers with authority and piece together the story. And then, like no other book we've had like over 40 contributors, ranging right of the way to Japan with kind of influential Japanese video game designers citing the Bitmap Brothers as like a huge moment for them when they discovered it imported in Tokyo in a small shop. And it's like, oh wow, the impact has been felt globally. And we've also got musicians. There's like hip-hop musicians from the 80s and 90s. We've got a member of Ultravox who contributed some of the soundtrack to them. So, you know, the resonance of this group has been felt more than even we understood. Like, I was a real Bitmap Brothers fanboy, so I wanted to make this book, but it appears to have touched upon something
in
the
industry. It was a cultural happening.
It was, yeah, yeah. I mean, so the thing about the Bitmap Brothers that makes them unique is they were the first game developer to court branding and to court a style, to put themselves out there in a way that a band would very consciously put themselves out there. Before that, you know, a picture of a coder in a magazine would literally be a man by a computer, probably startled by the flash. And then we've got the Bitmap Brothers, who literally posed in front of Robert Maxwell's helicopter wearing Ray-Bans and bomber jackets. And it was completely unseen before in games magazines. And they were putting, you know, kind of like cutting edge hip hop music, the likes of which people who play games would probably have no access to, into their games. So it was a really peculiar thing that they did. And it caused the resonance, caused an effect.
What were the early hits? What are the games that people may not realise were produced by them?
So their biggest hit is the Speedball series, which is sort of based, a very successful rip-off of a terrible sort of 1970s film called Rollerball. So it's a kind of futuristic sport. And they also developed a game called the Chaos Engine, like steampunk as a genre. Didn't really even exist at the time. They were kind of basing it on kind of H.G. Wells and comic books that were very obscure and bringing it into video games. So their kind of motif, if you like, was delivering things that no one expected in a package that no one expected, but just worked and seemed to resonate. A lot like you'd go to see a Christopher Nolan film and you'd expect it to feel a certain way, to sound a certain way, to have cinematography delivered in a certain way. The Bitmap Brothers were the first people to deliver each game that felt like it belonged in the same world. That's why we called it Universe, that everything seemed very cohesive, like soundtrack, graphics, everything just kind of fitted together. It had a flavour.
And Darren, tell us a bit about, from you know, your research for the book and putting it together, what was it that made them realise they could do this? You know, there's a degree of serendipity, I suppose, to in part, but also, you know, these ideas about selling it, this idea of a brand. Where did they get the conviction from that this was the time? Because it seems now like, oh, yes, well, of course, look at the huge billion-dollar industry that this became. But they can't have known, they might have suspected. Where did they grow that confidence from?
I mean, it comes from like any great creative group just wanting control. So in their initial contract, they were the first software developer to have in their contract full control over box art. So the size of their logo on the box, the artwork, they would sign everything off. So you could see that already that kind of like controlling the world of their product was already there. And then their marketing manager, who's a really sort of well-known character in the industry, Kathy Campos, saw an opportunity and led them into the idea of doing photo shoots with these like trench coats and Ray-Bans and looking like Echo and the Bunnymen or Depeche Mode or something like that. She said that there was such a dearth of press material for magazines. I mean, you just get screenshots, that if you gave them anything, they would print it. So they just knew that they had an opportunity. So it was a complete opening on behalf of Kathy and the Bitmap Brothers themselves to, you know, develop a style, to develop a, and, you know, just to push an ego on people where they weren't expecting it.
Tell us a little bit of how the company moved forwards, because what's interesting when you read the book, there's certainly many squabbles along the way, people falling out, people unsure about what should be done, successes, failures. You've got some, you know, real kind of colour in there. How did they manage to hold and not hold together?
There's a lot of great stories in there. There's stories about people being chased out of rooms with planks of wood, people sleeping under desks in perishing shorts. For some reason, Mike Montgomery is an exotic fish fan and keeps a tropical fish tank in the office, but doesn't always look after it very well. So, you know, there's this sense that they camped out, they lived in their office, and they all had very strong personalities. Eric Matthews, who was almost like the creative visionary behind the Bitmap Brothers, would characteristically sit on the edge of his desk smoking a cigarette, popping pixels into place and just making sure everything was absolutely perfect, deliberately delaying meetings by half an hour just to give this sense of the Bitmap Brothers ego whenever you kind of drop by. And in terms of their cohesion. Mike Montgomery's Natural Fair for Code, Eric Matthews was the visionary, the package, if you like. He could see these worlds, he could see how the game should feel, and direct Steve Kelly as well, another very talented coder. So they just had, they had the tools, they had the ego, they had the intuition, if you like, to bring it together as a trio. And simply, with this time of the industry, it was great for them for a few years. They were developing these games, which are still revered now and still thought of as being like tops of their genre. Some of them define genres. But the industry changed. Things moved to 3D. Team sizes ballooned. You were talking like a team of three and £25,000 to make the first game. That became like a daily charge, you know, like £30,000, £40,000 a day in the studio later on in the era. And they had to get 30, 40, 50 people. They had an office in the north and an office in London. And it just became too much. It just became a different thing, if you like. They were conducting an orchestra rather than being a band, and thus the fractures emerged and things start to change for them.
Darren, let me ask you, I know we probably talked about this before when we talked about the previous book when you came to speak with us, but yeah, it's still in a way counterintuitive to commemorate this era and explore it on the printed page. I mean, I guess people would be used to seeing artworks from this time maybe in galleries now, or examples of the video arts sort of lauded in that way. Remind us why you still have this conviction that, I mean, it's a beautiful thing, we should say.
Thank you. Our listeners
can't see this, but I have it here. Why is a book still the ideal way to sort of commemorate this extraordinary tale?
It fell out of a really self-indulgent sort of want to just make a complete book. I was a record cover designer and a book cover designer for years, and I wanted to make a complete book. So the first one I made was purely an experiment. I was turned down by publishing companies who thought it was far too indulgent to make a book about like one tiny bit of video game history. In fact, they were terrified of the idea. And I used crowdfunding to make it, and it just kind of resonated, and it became a company, and it kind of like took over my life. And, you know, now it's a business and it's flourishing, and we've got lots more books coming out. But I think
You've got a whole orchestra now.
I've got an orchestra, yeah. It's all going to fall apart. I've foreseen it myself. Yeah. I mean, like, art book publishing is a flourishing industry at the moment anyway, with the advent of digital, you know, things like Kindle and things like that, like, and the decline in the music industry as well, in terms of like physical objects you can put in your house that represent culture you like. I still think the printed book is the perfect delivery mechanism. You can't beat it with a digital platform. I mean, particularly with this era, like, people who would be interested in it are literate in the physical object anyway. They would have bought these games physically. They would have an attachment with physical objects. So first and foremost, we make the books as beautiful as we can because we want people to live with them forever. But yeah, I don't think you can top a book in terms of a delivery mechanism. And our documentary histories always end up being very long. This is 65,000 words. So it's something you need to live with and love. And, you know, we pick paper very carefully. We bind things very carefully. Like, we think about it as an object that you'll interact with.
And that kind of brings it full circle and back to their story in a way, because what's interesting is, you say at the conclusion of your book, you know, this story isn't important just as history. This story is important because it's the, you know, the pinprick and the balloon of a bloated kind of games industry, which is pumping out games that cost, you know, ridiculous amounts of money. And where are the startups? Where's the gap for the creatives, you know, like yourself in publishing? Is that a fear, do you think, for the games industry, that they realize it has become so corporate, so glossy, so huge, that actually they need a bit of a kind of shake up themselves?
Yeah, it's funny because, as you say, the games industry is so massive now, and almost things have to be so transparent. Game teams are huge. They're hundreds of people. They're global enterprises. People will work on the same game but never meet. So it's a very different market now. It's a very different development cycle. And you've got like three people making these games, which are still held up now as like some of the best games ever made. You know, we ruminate in the last chapter about how this happened in the first place and why it hasn't happened again since, that one team can create something so important that it's almost kind of like a Fracture Records moment. And there's a rise at the moment of something called indie gaming. So there are small teams able to make games that have a real impact on platforms like the PlayStation or the Xbox now. And so there are characters emerging very slowly. And I hope that this book and the resurgence of interest in older gaming will kind of influence new people to, you know, to court a style, and also to be really protective over their IP and their size, and create things that you know, that do become a pantheon of games rather than just like, yeah, as you say, cynical, big tentpole releases that year after year get. I think when you get people kind of rolling their eyes at the idea of like video games as an industry, it kind of does have itself to blame in that sense, because you just see the same games rolled out every year. Like, oh, it's another FIFA, it's another, you know. This was an era of creativity. They were taking a lot of risks and they were paying off. And I think the industry does hold these developers up in particular because they were able to do that and do it so well.
And Darren, maybe just finally then, if we look to the sort of indie movement, could you see this kind of influence again from one man or two or three people? Is it possible that given, you know, the whole landscape has changed so much, the industry has developed so much, that you could have another visionary, if you like, who could reshape things? Or is that just wishful thinking?
It feels like we're on the cusp of another 1988 moment where there is enough creativity going on, and there is enough, you know, with social media, if it's done correctly, then you can create and court an image. We speak to a group called Denneton Games, who made a game called Hotline Miami, which, pardon my French, was called a top-down fuck-em-up as a new genre. You just burst into rooms and you know, it's kind of based on the film Drive, and it's kind of extrapolated from that. And they created a really, really moody game, which no one had ever seen before and didn't really fit into any holes. We spoke to him, to Dennis, who's the lead artist, and he admitted that the Bitmap Brothers was his kind of pin-up go-to icon when he was a child. And we were going to speak to him anyway because we thought, okay, they do stylish games, but we managed to trace it back and realize that there was a connection there, which was amazing. So I think they would probably stand up as being likely future pinups. But yeah, there's very few around, but it'd be nice to see more. Like, indie games are very friendly. The Bitmap Brothers were very not interested in speaking to you. They were like a trendy uncle who just kind of like, you know, look over their glasses at you over dinner and you'd be like, oh my God, that's so cool. So yeah, it'd be nice to see a bit more sort of like faux arrogance with everything like that. People like that.
People do. They love it. Well, you can read about that trendy uncle in the Bitmap Brothers universe. Darren Wall is the editor-in-chief of Read Only Memory, the publisher. Darren, thanks very much for coming to see us again.
Thanks very much.
We'll be hearing from musician David Parho in just a moment, discussing his new album, Highway Songs, under the alias Papa M. But as well as those experimental works, David writes pretty pop songs too. Here's one from a few years ago. This is Foolish King.
If I cared about the insults my friends have made to me.
David Parho there with Foolish King. David Parho is the US musician who's been a staple of the indie rock scene for 20 years, with work ranging from challenging and genre-defining bands such as Slint to pop big hitters such as the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Interpol. And he's made countless ambient, reflective and folk-influenced solo albums along the way.
His latest release, Highway Songs, is one of those more eclectic records recorded under the alias Papa M, his first under that moniker for 12 years. Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to David about the inspiration behind his music. But first, here's a snippet of Walking on Coronado from the new album.
Before the record was announced, the solo album, I took on a little soundtrack thing for like a short documentary. And those are really fun to do just because you don't have to put together songs. It's more like developing one idea over a period of time. There'll be like a melodic theme for the whole thing. So yeah, it was like as soon as I finished the record and finished the artwork, it was like I had to go straight to writing and recording again. I mean, considering how much I've done that in the past and how that was just as necessary as like breathing, you know, is to make music and play guitar for quite a long time. Like I just lost all interest in music in general and I never thought that would happen, you know.
And I don't want to read too much into maybe slightly obvious points, I don't know, musically, but I mean, there's just one moment on the new record with a little sample of a voice saying, I love you, Daddy, on the song The Love Particle. And I mean, is family, since recent events, is that something that's really kind of been reinforced as a positive influence in your life? I mean, am I reading too much into that, or is that a real kind of thing coming through in the music?
Oh, not at all. Like that really is, you know, I always think of records as snapshots of a photograph of a period of time in somebody's life. You know, with this album, like the snapshot is that my kids are the most important thing to me. And so like, they're going to be part of the process. You know, it's funny because I think Ryan Murphy from Drag City said that I haven't released like a proper Papa M record of original material in like 12 years. And it was 10 years ago that I had my firstborn and my daughter. And, you know, now I've actually become a Papa, you know, like, you know, like I'd been calling myself Papa M, and then like now I actually am. So I guess it was all destiny.
You change between styles so deftly, but I mean, at some point in your career, you make these kind of challenging, kind of, you know, post rock and roll, kind of expansive, oddly structured songs. I mean, stuff that we first sort of heard around Slint and that kind of thing. And then you can make this incredibly beautiful folk music and sort of strange found sound kind of ambient stuff. Do you take a kind of a strange joy in that as well? Do you kind of want to alienate some people because they're probably the squares or something?
There probably is a punk side of me that does want to defy expectations. You know, I think that's probably normal for artists. But yeah, I was really aware of the alienation thing. Like I was like, this is what I'm into. Like, this is what I want to record. And I did it. And then when I would listen back to the songs, I was like, man, this is going to turn people off. Like, there's a lot of people aren't going to stomach this stuff. So my first sequence for the album was like, I pushed all the kind of heavier songs onto side two and strung them together as one long song. Cause I still think in terms of albums, but like my thought process was like, well, if some people don't like that sound, you know, they don't have to listen to side two, but it ended up kind of working against me, I think. And so I asked Brian McMahon from Slint if he could help me sequence the record. He's really good at that. Like, he sequenced Spiderland, and, you know, I remember when we were working on it, like we all tried out different sequences, and we had two outtakes from that album. And my sequence was totally different from the one that ended up on Spiderland. And it had those two extra songs, and it was Brian's idea to get rid of those and start with Breadcrumb Trail and end with Good Morning Captain and put Washer at the beginning of side two, you know, like, I put like the stronger songs at the beginning, and but it really worked. You know, he saw a big picture that I didn't see, and he helped me put together the sequence for this album so that for a first listen, there are some surprises, you know, but it's not just a novelty. You know, I'm hoping that it's varied enough so that people will want to go back and listen to it again and not just like, oh, I listened to it once and, you know, I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I wanted it to stand repeated listenings, you know. So Brian had a good overall concept for how the sequence should go and kind of broke up the heavier songs. And it's funny, the very last song which is the only song really with vocals, I was trying to think of guitar melodies to add, and I just started doing the hair metal kind of shredding over it. and I was like, you know what, this is fun, you know, like I'm just going to leave it on there. If it alienates people, that's fine, you know. And I was like, I'm just gonna do it because I'm enjoying it, and I can do it, and you probably can't, you know. So I was like,
yeah,
it was a little bit of arrogance in there too, but it, you know, I understand that, like, the sort of tackiness around the metal genre or whatever, and especially like soloing like that, like Eddie Van Halen, is like not cool.
yeah. When you bow your head from something that I said, then you teach me to cry.
It kind of is cool, hasn't it?
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. It's like, I just sort of don't care what's cool. Like, if it's cool to me, that's good enough, you know?
You mentioned there, obviously, like, quite a lot of your albums. I mean, there's not much singing on this one, but you are a singer as well. And one of the things that I really like about some of your work is when it comes to lyrics and specifically kind of naming things, your albums, just they all have just very, like, evocative titles. I mean, like, you know, Live from a Shark Cage. I don't know what that's alluding to, but just the image in your head is a very I've instantly got a picture there of a very strange scene. I mean, how is it that you put these kind of phrases together? Do you labour over it for weeks, or do you just kind of think of it in a day and just stick it on there because that's something needs a name? How do you come up with that?
Yeah, I guess the song titles, I mean, they all have working titles, which are usually just kind of broad and one or two words. But then I have to listen back to it and sort of think of whatever it evokes or whatever I'm trying to convey or whatever. But then there's other times like Whatever Mortal was just, I wrote a list of album titles on a notebook page and just sort of went through them and crossed stuff off. And that was the one I ended up with. but I thought it, yeah, it had multiple interpretations and it's, yeah, like a sort of a sense of humor to it. But then Live from a Shark Cage was more, I needed an album title, and it was at the time on the Discovery Channel, there was it was Shark Week, and tomorrow it's live, you know, we're filming Live from a Shark Cage. And I was like, oh, that's great. You know, like, I feel like I'm in a shark cage a lot of times, you know, like I'm protected, but like, I'm also being swarmed, you know, like,
yeah.
So I thought it can be sort of I guess it's just totally general.
Yeah. Yeah.
For Highway Songs, it's funny that I actually labored more over this album title, and it's so, so basic, you know, like.
Well, that was the thing. I wanted to come to that because I actually only, while I was speaking to you just right now, I only really kind of put two and two together that, and I don't know whether you had this relevance in the title yourself, but you were talking about your motorcycle accident. And I was like, well, that's on a highway, isn't it? And that's kind of framed maybe a lot of these songs. And it's kind of, again, I wondered whether that was like a nod to that, or maybe even like a sort of a darkly humorous nod to that, or maybe it's just a complete coincidence. But it's actually a very apt title in that sense. But it also ties into that sort of, I don't know, I guess alluding to the highway as well, which has always been a bit of a kind of, I guess, an American folk tradition, hasn't it?
Yeah.
You say you kind of labored over that title. Where did that title come from?
When I was coming up with album titles, I had all these, I guess, sort of arty ideas or like meaningful ideas for album titles. And I just started to think like, man, this is cheesy. Like whenever I hear somebody's coming out with a new album, it seems like they're trying almost too hard to be clever. And I was trying to think of album titles that I liked. And I was like, you know, I really like just the black and white ones, the ones that just tell facts, like Stephen Reich's Music for 18 Musicians. Like that doesn't tell you anything. I mean, it tells you a lot, but it doesn't try to paint a picture for you, you know? And, yeah. Or like Leonard Cohen's Songs from a Room, it's honest and, you know, it's just expressing facts. And, I also talked to Brian McMahon about that, like about album titles and like how I wanted just something that was like, you know, maybe I should just call it Songs for Turntables or, you know, like, or something, yeah, yeah. You know? and so we just kind of talked about it and ended up with Highway Songs, or he was thinking Songs from the Highway, which I liked just, yeah, because it has like the Americana aspect of, if the CD was at a truck stop, I could see some, you know, trucker picking it up and just being like, oh yeah, I'm going to check this out. And it's
some unfortunate trucker getting a face full of metal from David.
Yeah. And then quickly like pulling the CD out and throwing it out the window, you know, like, so it's like, it was really just sort of like had a classic sound to it. And then also, you know, I was thinking, you know, we're on the highway of life or whatever, like I hit some bumps, you know, like literally and just emotionally, you know, you just keep your eyes on the road, you know, you should keep on trucking. Like, yeah. So, and I felt like it was accurate in that way, you know, like these are about the bumps in the highway and like how you sort of cope with them.
That was David Parho speaking to Tom Hall, and Highway Songs, the album, is out now. We're talking about design to end the programme today with Clara Gajero-Westaway and Adrian Westaway. The duo make up London Design Partnership Special Projects, and they've certainly caught the design world's attention recently with a very practical solution to some of the world's more perplexing problems.
Missing Pages are three tongue-in-cheek manuals designed in the style of flat-pack furniture manuals, which aim to remind people how to take care of each other. They range from how to remember why you love someone, always useful, to a short, easy physical workout. Clara and Adrian join us now to discuss it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Clara, either you're not very busy or you're very inspired. How did you find time, or what made you want to do this piece of parody that takes the kinds of instructions, I guess, that we see that come with our flat pack furniture, and you've slightly spoofed what should happen after you've kind of put up the flat pack furniture?
I guess we often have to answer the question how it is to work together as a couple and to run a design studio together. And I think answering that question made us think that we never fight at Special Projects, but actually something that makes us fight all the time is building flat pack furniture. So we thought, you know, as good designers and inventors, we thought, is there a way that we can solve that? And we thought that maybe there were these missing pages that have never been printed that could allow people to have a better experience when building flat pack furniture. So yes, we started with the couple that is about to kill each other and how duo can help you solve the issue by giving you instruction on how to fold a little origami art with a secret message that you can give to your partner. Then we played around with another problem that we often had, and is, you know, after you build maybe a bookshelf, you end up being all sore with the back pain or wrist pain. And so we actually involved a very talented personal trainer and asked which were the best stretches to do after such a mission of building a bookshelf. And they gave us great guidance. So we made this little missing pages called Stretchy, where you are guided through a set of exercises to get you back on shape.
Adrian, let me jump in there and ask you about this, because this is fun and it's also looking at everyday problems maybe with a bit of, and bringing a bit of levity to it, as well as some design smarts. Do you think that maybe sometimes that is missing in your profession more broadly, that maybe whether it's because people are too busy to take a moment to stop and think, actually, we could bring a bit of humour to this and there's a different way of looking at things? Is that a problem just with the demands on people's time, or is it maybe a business that can be a bit starchy, that sometimes needs to take itself a bit less seriously almost?
Yeah, I think like the sort of experience, the user experience is a lot longer and a lot bigger than most people think. So, you know, when you buy furniture, for example, you put the furniture up, but there's not much fanfare or celebration when you've actually finished. And that's really when your relationship with that object actually begins, you know, when it's actually, you know, been built. And we've done a lot of, I guess, more serious work in the past that's involved user manuals and kind of out-of-box experiences. And so we've seen, like, firsthand just how powerful that experience can be. And by adding a bit of delight and a bit of magic into these kind of unexpected places, you can actually totally transform the way that people experience that product. So, yeah, this is very much like a bit of a kind of funny kind of take on that. But I guess it has roots in more kind of, serious problem solving as well.
Because what's interesting is, I guess, when you get your IKEA furniture, when you come home, I think some of the names of your products make me think a little bit of the world of IKEA, but when you get your products home and you start reading the instructions, what they need to do with those instructions is give you something that can be done without too much language. They're trying to tell stories in pictograms. And that's, I guess, quite a good discipline for a design agency as well. So as a process for you to go through, Clara, it's interesting that you had to then take on emotional concerns, and there's the tiny bit of text in here, but how do you solve people's emotional issues just by pictograms?
That's a very good question. I guess we always concentrate on the unquantifiable aspects of life when designing. For us, empathy, well-being, delight are very important, and that's what design can bring to people's life. I guess the pictogram was one of, you know, a tool, a language really, that we used in this case to bring this delight and this empathy, I guess, to a more mundane task, or to a task that is seen as a mundane task usually. But sometimes, you know, you could do this with words, you can do this with digital apps, you know, there are many, many ways. For us, the pictograms, I think, were a great tool because, they, as you said, they are like international. So we hope that the missing pages could be printed by anyone anywhere in the world and added to their furniture building exercise to make it a bit better.
And about this idea of empathy, because it's interesting, we were talking about, and you've got some examples of an earlier project you did, which was in the sort of mobile phone space. And again, it was looking at how do we make this thing, which is all supposedly about communication and bringing people together. That's what's always on all the adverts. But maybe there are people who get left behind. If, in this case, it might be older people who are struggling to get to grips, literally or metaphorically, with the technology at their disposal. You both seem to have a real sensibility about this. Is it just because you're quite empathetic, or did you have to sort of work at building that up in a project, for example, like that mobile phone one?
It's kind of two things. I think we are kind of naturally quite empathetic, but it's also something that we've trained in. So we trained at the Helen Hamlin Center, which is part of the Royal College of Art, and in user-centered design. So it's kind of been like hammered into us since the beginning. And that particular project was really interesting because it was we were originally asked to develop a new phone for Samsung aimed at older adults. And if you kind of went out and looked at the, you know, Carphone warehouse or whatever at the time, and you said, you know, I want to buy a phone for my granny, what do you got? Like, they would show you these horrendous, like, phones that, like, literally, like, had less buttons than a calculator. You know, it was very simple. They were really kind of, the trend was to dumb things down. And actually what we found, you know, through hanging out with a lot of older adults was that they actually really wanted like a normal phone. They wanted the same phone as everyone else. They just weren't able to learn how to use it. So we were then able to kind of redesign the way they learned how to use it and kind of then enable them to use normal phones. So it's like a user manual in that sense became like a really powerful way of learning how to use that tech.
And what's interesting is, you know, I guess when you look at this, first of all, it is funny and it's humorous and it is a little bit of a spoof. But the strange thing is, the more you think about it, I could imagine actually any company thinking, do you know what, that's a really good idea. You know, why don't we tell people to have a glass of champagne when they finally get their furniture up? Why don't they find some way of celebrating that what they've done? And maybe they do need to have a kind of a bit of a hug at the end of the whole process. Clara, do you think that maybe somebody will look at this and think, actually, there's a very human aspect that needs to be added to the process of, you know, flat pack furniture?
Yes. I really hope so. We've done these missing pages for flat pack furniture, and we really believe that there is a next step that companies can support you to do and, you know, allow you to celebrate. But this is not just for that. I think, as Adrian said before, I think there are like hundreds of opportunities out there, like in traditional businesses, I guess, think that their job is finished once the product has been bought. But actually, that is just when the relationship begins. So that first opening of the box or the first period of familiarization with the product and the one that follows are fundamental steps to be designed.
What about this idea that, look, you know, great design should cut through? We talked about, you know, pictograms, that works very well. But it shouldn't really be an additional discipline, should it, I guess, to look at utility or user-focused design? I mean, all good design should be user focus, shouldn't it? Did you think sometimes maybe that the discipline itself loses a bit of discipline and sometimes fails to remember that main fact?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point. Like, we're kind of lucky, like, we teach at a few different design schools and, you know, we get to kind of meet students as they're learning design. And I mean, a lot of like design schools are talking about this, but I do think it's brushed aside quite a lot. Often people see it as a whimsical kind of gimmicky extra, when actually like it's really one of the most important things. And when you look at many products like smartphones, for example, the thing that differentiates them is these little touches of magic that really kind of bring them to life.
You've said a key word there, because we were also told that you're a member of the Magic Circle.
Yes, yeah, I am, yeah.
And did you think, first of all, you might be a magician before you became a designer?
I became a magician when I was 11. So I kind of was a magician before everything else. And yeah, I'm obsessed with magic. And actually, like, amazingly, like, especially in the last few years, we've actually been teaching magic as a way of teaching design, actually looking at the way that magicians design illusions and tricks and taking that magic thinking and then applying it to design. So it's super exciting for me because I get to do like literally everything that I love at the same time. So it's very good fun.
And Clara, does he pull a few tricks in the office as well?
yes, he does. He's actually, when we first met, you know, I don't know if you know, but we're married. And when we first met, Adrian wanted to invite me out for dinner, but as a good Italian, you know, I made him work hard for that. So I asked him to make a new magic trick every day, and then I would consider. And I think you had to do 2 months of magic tricks.
Yeah, 2 months. But I, like, the first month was okay because I knew quite a few tricks. But like, yeah, after that, I was like up every night reading my magic books, going to the magic shop.
Day
like, what do you got? What do you got? Yeah.
Day 51.
Yeah.
Well, it would seem ridiculous.
That's a movie,
opportunity,
isn't it, Tom?
Possibly. It would seem ridiculous to pass up the opportunity. Because this is germane to what we're talking about, can we workshop some magic skills that speak to some of the design stories that you've been telling us? Particularly in something that works on radio?
Actually to do it like a trick
on the radio? I
actually brought an envelope. I have a trick for you, but no. I don't know. You'll have to sort of describe what's happening.
Okay,
it's not really
fine.
Designed
we're
for
good
radio.
At that.
This is magic. Magic commentary is going to happen.
And genuinely, we didn't know that you were going to do this.
No. So we wanted to make a... I'll see if this works. I'll see if it should be good. We wanted to make a self-working trick that literally anyone could do. So it would be kind of embedded in a card. So I'm going to give this to you. You just have to follow the instructions.
Oh, great. So this is perfect. This is absolutely so. There's a card, and on the front, there is a hand holding a red playing card. You can't see what's on the card. And you turn it over, and it says,
perfect.
Clear your mind and put your finger on one of the cards. Now, on the right-hand side, there are four little cards at the bottom. And I just put my finger on one of these at the bottom.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Now slide it into this pocket. It's going, and you slide the card up, and you pop it in there perfectly at the top of a kind of clear window, which I think allows me then to turn over again.
Absolutely.
And then on the other side, it said your chosen card, and it seems that I've chosen the Queen of Hearts. It's showing me the Queen of Hearts through the clear window. But on the next page, there's a tiny, tiny little envelope. And it says, please open this envelope to see our prediction. Oh, my God. And written on the card, it says, you will choose the Queen of Hearts.
Congratulations. It worked.
Oh, my goodness. So that is kind of crazy. And...
It's kind of like we wanted to make something like literally the most amazing thing you could receive in an envelope. And we
that's
tried
kind of freaking me out. That's
I know,
like,
I'm just thinking about it for a moment.
So what's so strange is, everyone listening, we didn't know that Adrian was going to do a trick. The trick worked amazingly and I can't work it out.
Well, the cool thing is as well is that once you kind of get this, like you can keep this and you know, you'll be able to look at it later. You can actually kind of sort of learn it and then do it to other people. So it's kind of breaking the rules, but I think in a sort of semi-acceptable way.
I was going to say, yeah, the magic circle, they can be a little unhappy about that sort of thing.
But the amazing thing is that you've told this trick through pictograms again.
Yep.
So through pure use of simple imagery. Well, what an amazing way to tie together all of the elements, Tom.
I know we do radio magic every week, Andrew, but that was a first for the Monocle Weekly. So
yes.
Something pretty special. And the whole project is amazing. And you guys talk about it so well. Thanks for
so
coming.
So where can people head to
it.
See more of your work and find out what you're up to?
Yeah, I mean, our website is specialprojects.studio. And there's a lot of stuff. I mean, a lot of what we do is totally secret, a bit like magic. So there's only like a sort of public selection of stuff. But definitely head on there and there's lots of kind of projects to see.
It's magic. Guys, thanks so much for coming to see us. Clara and Adrian from Special Projects, talking about your missing pages and a whole host more. Thanks for coming on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Andrew, there we are. Edition 386 of the Monocle Weekly bites the dust. What have we learned? We've learned about the origin stories of computer games. We've learned to take better care of one another. A classic show, though. And nice to see different sort of genres represented. We had a good musical guest. We had a design story,
yeah.
A publishing story as well. That's a nice bright spot, isn't it? I'd like to see an independent publisher going gangbusters.
And also, he's just so good at talking about something which you feel that many people who, unfairly, you feel that many people who get sucked into the world of computer games is because they don't really want to read or they don't want to be very literate. And he manages to combine the two in a really kind of interesting and important way. The other thing to say is first weekend of December, come down to the Monocle Fair, the Monocle Christmas Fair. It's going to be held here at Midori House. Open doors. We're going to have a great market. We're going to be serving glühwein. There's going to be a reindeer and there's going to be Santa Claus.
Actual Santa Claus from Rovaniemi.
Actual Santa Claus. So you just have to go on to monocle.com and you'll see everything you need to come down and have a bit of a party with us.
Festive revelry and ribaldry.
And it's all free.
Wonderful stuff. Thanks to our producer, Tom Hall. Thanks to our researcher, Daphne Karnesis, and our studio manager, Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly returns next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck. Goodbye.